Trump's online post to investment banks and other institutional clients for $100,000 a month. Former Wall Street regulators say the arrangement raises serious questions about insider trading laws because paying subscribers could receive market-moving information before it's available to the public. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Schwab, offering the Schwab Teen Investor Account, where teens can gain hands-on investing experience. It's co-owned by parents and teens, so parents can monitor the account while teens learn how to invest. More at schwab.com. This is NPR.
Lovely music means it's time for The Conversation on WVIK. It's a weekly celebration of local radio the way it's meant to be brewed. This week, my guests are Margaret Farrar and Adam Call. I'm Kai Swanson. I hope you'll stick around for this week's Conversation on WVIK. There are so many reasons I am just ecstatic and thrilled about this week's episode, and I'll tell you some other reasons why. Let's probably some anxiety built in there, too. But my guests are two friends of long standing who have collaborated over a great distance and a considerable amount of time on a book that I think you're going to find fascinating. The book is called Becoming Utopia: History, Heritage, and Sustainability in the American Midwest. It's about Bishop Hill, spoiler alert. And the authors are Dr. Margaret Farrar, professor of political science at John Carroll University in Ohio, and Dr. Adam Call, professor of anthropology right here at Augustana College in River City. And I'm so grateful that you are both here. But I know I don't normally do shows with two guests, so I'm gonna kind of sort of tag team between the two of you. Adam, you've been on the program before, so I won't go into the deep bio, but could you tell us just at least this much, how on earth did you find Augustana College?
How did I find
Augustana? Yeah, and how'd you get here?
Yeah, I had been working at a small liberal arts college in Buffalo, New York for a couple of years, but in that position, I wasn't allowed to teach any anthropology courses. So I was looking around for a different kind of liberal arts, and I fell in love with the liberal arts college model. So yeah, when this job opened up, I was thrilled to get to be here. Yeah.
Yeah. So. And now, though, I got to pick on Margaret a little bit more because it's your first time here on the program. But just to shorthand it a little bit, Margaret was on the faculty here at Augustana. That's how we got to know each other. I swear you were 14 when you left. Mm-hmm. And now you've been at John Carroll doing amazing things. But I want to rewind a little bit more than that. Where did you grow up?
I actually grew up outside of Cleveland, Ohio, which is where I am now. Mm-hmm. So when I took the job at John Carroll, it was going home.
Yeah.
But I lived away from Cleveland for a lot of years.
And where did you head off to school, or did you stay in the Cleveland area for college?
I went to the College of Worcester, which is just south of Cleveland, for my college experience. And that's where I fell in love with the liberal arts. It was such a transformative experience for me. So I knew going to graduate school then that I would want to end up at a liberal arts college.
What were, in terms of disciplines, any stops along the way to political science? Sometimes people start in one area and they start thinking about other things. And then tell us about that journey, if you don't mind.
I am happy to discuss that journey, although it is a little rocky. I started off as an international business major because I thought that I was going to make a lot of money. And then I took one economics class and hated it with every fiber of my being. Sorry, economists out there. But the classes that I had the most sort of credits for was political science. And so I drifted into political science, found political theory, fell in love with the discipline. And from then on out, it was political science and political theory all the way.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic. Oftentimes, people who get into that realm get to do some interesting internships and experiences like that. Did you have any of those either as an undergrad or a graduate student?
I had a really important internship where I worked for a big law firm in downtown Cleveland. And what it taught me, which I tell all of my students now, is that I definitely didn't want to be a lawyer. And that was, to me, just as important as learning what you do want to do is learning what you don't want to do. And that was, it was very significant for me because that was a path that I had considered and then stopped considering.
I'm smirking because back when I was working in the newsroom here 180 years ago, we would tell students from Augustana, because we didn't really have a formalized broadcast journalism program. So we got kids who were in poli-sci and English all over the place. I said, you know, if you, after working here, decide this is not what you want to do, that's as much of a success as finding out it is what you want to do. So I thought that resonated with me a little bit. And I always found very interesting a research focus that I know was the subject of a book you wrote, but was that part of like a doctoral dissertation? I'm talking about the public spaces. And if you tell us a little bit about that area of study and how you got into it.
Sure. You know, place has always been central to my research, something I have only realized in the past few years. But when I started writing my dissertation and started working on that project, I was in graduate school at Penn State, which, if you know, is in the middle of Pennsylvania, and it is not near any city whatsoever. And I found myself really, really missing city spaces. And so I thought, what better way to channel my sort of nostalgia for city spaces than to write a dissertation where I can visit a city and talk about a city and talk about how important cities are. And so I ended up writing about Washington, D.C. and public space and public planning in Washington, D.C. and how our ideas of citizenship are reflected in our sort of understanding of how our cities look.
I think about that because I knew that was part of your past. And whenever I get to go to D.C., usually for work, I'm always thinking, trying to be aware of public space. Does that book have to be entirely rewritten given the iconoclastic take on public spaces we're enduring right now? I think the latest thing was gold gilt all over everything. I don't know. Have you been, are you still looking at that either with academic fascination or morbid sort of?
I do still follow it quite a bit. But a couple of the chapters that I wrote in the original book, I think still apply. So one of the chapters is about monumentalization and sort of what monumental architecture does and doesn't tell us about history, which has some direct sort of application to our current book. The other chapter was about surveillance and how we make ourselves public and are made public through surveillance cameras, security systems, all that stuff. And both of those things have just been exacerbated, you know, in the past couple decades.
Well, I'm teasing out themes here, and I'm going to shift back to Adam for a second, because you have done a lot of publishing and writing and research. And one of the things that I find very fascinating about your work is thinking of place, but in terms of cultural conveyance and tourism, and which is, another form of being identified by place. So remind us a little bit about some of the work that you have done. And as I think you're understanding how this is coming together in this beautiful book.
Yeah, I started my work originally out in the west of Ireland in a small village there, looking at traditional Irish music and how the tourism industry was kind of shifting the meaning of that music, shifting kind of local social relations. There's different power dynamics that come in when you have a ton of tourism like they get in the west coast of Ireland. And so there's a lot of money flowing in, and some people, you know, benefit from that. Other people might be kind of cut off from the kind of new industries that develop through tourism. And because there's all this attention from tourism, and again, this kind of feeds into the current book too, when lots and lots of people come to visit your place for, you know, reasons of culture, not just landscape, but also the culture that you've kind of created over many generations, that attention gives you a kind of different sense of yourself, right? You have a kind of more self-awareness or self-consciousness. And so I focused in on traditional music because it's such a, like, you know, kind of iconic expression of Irish culture. And because I play music too, so, you know, it was just kind of a nice fit. So I started looking there at their sense of place culturally, really, and have kind of carried that through a bunch of other projects, including this one.
So now I want to get into this book here because I am so enthralled by it. And, you know, full disclosure, I'm only halfway through, but I have learned so much. The book is Becoming Utopia. It's been released by University of Nebraska Press, and it is about Bishop Hill, which is, I think many of our listeners are at least familiar with it, but I think I'm probably more familiar than most, and I've learned so much from this book. So Bishop Hill, I'm going to give it short shrift here, but utopian colony established about an hour or so outside of the Quad Cities. There was no Quad Cities at the time, obviously. But my earliest recollections were tagging along on college campus ministry retreats in the nearby town of Andover. Uh-huh. And then going over and looking at these old buildings, right? And then, of course, being fascinated because if you go into the cemetery and you know where to look, there is a gravestone that, whereas others say born, da-da-da-da, died, da-da-da-da, this one says born, da-da-da-da, and murdered, da-da-da-da. But I don't want to give too much away now. How did Bishop Hill come on your radar screens?
When I got the job at Augustana, I knew I wanted to keep working in the west of Ireland, but I knew that that was going to be expensive and probably couldn't get there every summer or even every other summer. So I was looking around for a local project where there was some tourism so I could kind of study some of the same themes. And I thought, you know, a longer term, slower project. And so, Bishop Hill intrigued me because I knew there was this kind of heritage tourism there because of the history of the colony. And then very quickly after that, Margaret and I had a conversation over dinner at her house. And, you know, it was clear that we were going to work together on this, you know, that we had very similar, even though we came from different disciplines, very similar overlapping interests. And it was going to, we got very excited over a beautiful scallop dinner that she prepared. So
I have no memory of the scallops, but I do remember the dinner. I didn't know anything about Bishop Hill. Had gone to visit during Lucianites, during one of my first years at Augustana, and there was it was so otherworldly to me. You know, Lucianites, they have the Luminaria set up, they have they have the elves running around, they have all the craft gifts stores open up, and there was a concert in the Colony Church that was just stunning. Mm. And it was such a beautiful, magical place that I became really intrigued with it. And so when Adam and I began talking about these utopian colonies and how they're reinventing themselves with tourism, it became clear that there was something really interesting there to look at.
So you get interested in this, but then, I mean, I think if I got the chronology right, all of a sudden you get this amazing opportunity to move up the ranks and away from here. So did that sort of say, well, it's a nice idea, but, or did you make a commitment at that time, you know, we're going to make this work somehow?
We had already begun significant collaboration by the time that I left Augustana. Okay. And so I think if we weren't so far along at that point, it might have died on the vine or just petered out with an article. But we'd already done a number of interviews. I'd presented a conference paper. I think you'd presented something.
So it had some momentum.
It had some momentum. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so, you know, and I knew that Anne and I would continue to be in touch. And so it wasn't surprising to me that it continued. It was surprising to me that it became a book and that it lasted 15 years.
Yeah. But here we are 15 years later. The book is Becoming Utopia, and I hope you get a chance to look at it, friends. But there is so much in this book that is beneath the surface. So my understanding, admittedly still extremely facile, always had an arm's length to it, right? Because I'm a product of a family that was itself a product of the Augustana Synod, which was in some ways set up in opposition to these heretics, right? So that was always kind of, well, it's curious, it's interesting, but, you know, that kind of thing. I learned so much about this, even their time. So let's, would one of you please introduce to us Erik Jansson?
Yeah, he was a pietist, a preacher who had, as a teenager, a sort of conversion experience and became, you know, kind of charismatic preacher in this very poor part of Sweden and attracted, apparently, attracted huge followings and, you know, was just this amazing preacher, but very, very strict in his theology and very provocative, too. So he was preaching kind of against the state-run Swedish Lutheran Church. And so there was this sort of conflict, really, in Sweden for, you know, many years as he was gathering more and more of a following. And he purposely would antagonize the Swedish Lutheran Church, you know, and there were book burnings, for example. That was one of the things that really set the public against him and his followers. And so they eventually left. They saw, like a lot of people in the mid-1800s, saw this growing United States as a place where they could kind of establish their own sort of community. And so they pooled all their money together. They, it was about 1,200 of them initially traveled by boat. And a lot of them peeled off as they made their way to what is now Bishop Hill. So in New York City, a bunch of them peeled off and just couldn't hack it. A lot of people died on the boat on the Atlantic.
170 on that first voyage. Yes. Wow.
Yeah. And then more people peeled off in Chicago. And then they walked from Chicago to this land that they had purchased in Henry County. They walked probably, we suspect they walked on something called the Great Sauk Trail, which had been used by the Sauk and Fox people for generations and many other people generations before them. So they're already walking on this like sort of historic landscape until they come to Bishop Hill. And then they establish a communal society where they all live and work communally. But as you pointed out, a few years into it, there was a conflict that I don't need to get into, but he was murdered by an outsider to the community. Yeah. So very dramatic origin story.
Well, and among the many things I learned, now we're going to get the political angle in here, is that, you know, there was always the short form of the story was religious liberty, religious freedom, and they come to the new world after this oppression in the old world. But he was really a jerk. I mean,
he was in fact a jerk.
If this guy was in your town, you would go to the city council and ask for a zoning change. Right? It had nothing to do with the religious liberty. He was, and he would his followers would spit on people who represented the church. But it was that uncovering that was that part of the political story going on here. Or?
It was. I would say that it was part of the unpacking of some of the narratives that Bishop Hill tells about itself versus what history might actually show, right? And so this narrative of religious persecution and fleeing to America to escape religious persecution is a very common trope for all of these kinds of religious communities. Mm-hmm. But when you unpack that religious persecution, it doesn't look exactly like persecution so much as it looks like conflict and antagonism and conflict and antagonism leading to near expulsion / emigration, right?
Yeah.
And so it's just a very different story under the surface.
Well, and then the other thing that I think was always sort of under the surface of the narratives that I had grown up with is, you know, they got this land so cheaply because we're only about a dozen years from the end of the Black Hawk War, the where Black Hawk tried to reassert his rights, and it was a bloody affair, and it opened up all this cheap land. And again, something else you guys taught me. I always knew there was this nefarious treaty.
Yes.
But I didn't know that it was built in the wording.
Yes.
They said that they would have access to their land, the Sauk and Meskwaki people, for as long as the U.S. government held it. Well, that sounds great, right? But they already knew when they were writing those words that they were going to sell this stuff and make some money and invite more settlers. But that then ends the treaty obligation.
Yes.
And I had no idea it was that bald-faced.
Yes.
It's- and Yeah.
Yes, it's a terrible example. I mean, it's a terrible and great example of how fraudulent some of these treaties, most of these treaties, were.
Right, right. And it just weaving it further into the story that is Illinois, which is like every state in the union, there are some wonderful chapters and there are some awful chapters.
Yes.
Right. So they get over here and they pick up land really cheap. But there was also this narrative that it was somehow communal, which it was in the Swedish understanding of kommun, but it was not communist in this sort of traditional political sense so much as the biblical sense. So thank you for illustrating that for me. But for somebody who's just tuning in, what's the difference between this biblical communism and Herr Marx?
I think there are a couple things going on. I think that the biblical communism, I would say it this way, Bishop Hill is not unique in that many of these utopian societies that were founded in the 19th century were responding to some of the growing pains of capitalism, right, that were being experienced in the cities. And so they adopted very consciously a communalistic framework, which means sharing things in common, sharing property in common, sharing resources in common, sharing ownership of buildings and goods that are produced, all that stuff was communal, right? But it was not Marxist communism in the sense that there was not a sort of overarching ideology of communism that was driving this. There was not sort of an economic rationality behind this. It was woven into the faith of, in order to be successful and in order to share in the goods that God has given us, these are shared resources. These are shared property, right? So ideologically, it looks different and behaves differently than we typically think about communism per se.
Sure. And of course, the fundamental flaw of any human form of organization is the involvement of humans, right?
Yes.
So, when they started to see that there was some initial economic success from doing this, which is clear. I mean, if you pool your resources, I mean, to this day, farm co-ops, if not everybody needs a harvester, so that kind of thing, they then kind of overreached. And they got involved in speculative trading and all this kind of stuff. Again, more things that I learned about from you. So I'm going to tee you up now, and we're going to have more time for this after our break, which is coming up here in a moment. But just a quick response, what surprised you in the writing of the book?
For me, what surprised me is just how multi-layered and complex it is. Mm-hmm. And, one of the stories that, and this is really due to preservation and tourism, one of the stories that is often told about Bishop Hill is that people love going out there because it reminds them of simpler times. And in fact, it's a really complicated story. There's so much going on. So the more we dug into this, the more rabbit holes we were allowed to go down and just to kind of uncover how complicated it really is.
Yeah. Do you have a short answer to that? Because we have more time later. But
I would just echo Adam's answer that this idea of a simpler time was proven to be not simple in any way. And that was really exciting.
Well, and then plugging this back into something we talked about earlier about tourism, there are not many reasons to drift off of Interstate 74 or 80 and find your way to Bishop Hill, Illinois. And so without the tourism angle, which we're going to get to in just a minute, it's would there be a Bishop Hill?
There might not be. I mean, I think it has really been a major part of the health of that community.
Mm-hmm. And the region.
Yes.
Because it extends beyond that. And in fact, when I mentioned, so Andover happened to be where this, the Church of Sweden sent a pastor to try to be set up as almost an antipodal response to it. And then he goes on to wind up establishing this little college that happens to be across the street from us right now. Okay, so friends, my guests are Dr. Margaret Farrar from John Carroll University, Dr. Adam Call from Augustana College. Their book is Becoming Utopia. It's all about Bishop Hill, and we've got a lot more to talk about, so don't you dare go anywhere. We'll be right back on The Conversation on WVIK.
VIK, Quad Cities NPR, comes from the Regional Development Authority, distributing funds from the Rhythm City Casino Resort to help make the Quad Cities a more vibrant and inclusive community. Learn more at rdauthority.org. And support for WVIK also comes from Source Bookstore, offering thousands of used and out-of-print books in all genres, music and movies, Open 7 days a week at 232 West 3rd Street in Davenport, serving the Quad Cities for 86 years. That's Source Bookstore. And WVIK also thanks these listeners for their recent support of local public radio across our region. Janet Kohler, Charles Collins, Jared Schwartz, Clayton Johnson, and Laura from Clinton. Your support helps make WVIK possible. Thank you.
I'm Steve Anditch from Rock Island, and WVIK is my NPR station.
Well, welcome back. We are live here in the studios. I got to tell you a little story, though, friend, as you're listening to this particular episode of The Conversation. We had a little bit of a hiccup this week at WVIK, where some power surges and those sorts of things that I don't understand have completely incapacitated two of the three broadcast studios here. So we're hanging on by a thread, friends. But my guests, Adam Call and Margaret Farrar, are being very good sports. We're all huddled together in about a 3x3 closet, sharing microphones and all that. But it's personally very enjoyable for me to have you both here because I consider you both friends. And I love it when my friends teach me things. So another thing you've taught me through Becoming Utopia, and I don't know who wants to take the lead on this, but another great story that I grew up knowing, thanks to folks like Rold Tweet, from whom we'll hear in a few minutes, was the legend of the Davenport tablets, right? Yes. Mm-hmm. And I think if some folks will be familiar, where some guys that were part of the precursor to the Putnam set up they buried some things that were meant to be mysterious tablets, kind of like the phony Viking rune stones up in Minnesota. But what I never made the connection with, and it's absolutely compelling now, I can't get it out of my head, is that this played into a white American effort to delegitimize the indigenous communities. You know, these mounds that we were finding, you know, that were thousands in some cases of years old, the whole Cahokia culture that was being uncovered. By legitimizing their tie to contemporary indigenous communities was fearful. To the white power structures. We had to make sure that we thought of them as savages, as it says in the Declaration of Independence, and not highly cultured societies. I never made that connection. Mm-hmm. Where was the genesis of making that connection?
It was just sort of placing the history of Bishop Hill in a much larger context of how the Midwest came into being, really, as we know it today. And a huge piece of that, part of the settlers coming in, was, as you said, this kind of, you know, erasure of Native presence, really, in lots of different ways. And so in the mid to late 1800s, this whole series of stories started to develop that archaeologists today they simply call it the mound builder myths. Mm-hmm. You know, so who built all of the mounds that you find across the Midwest and the Southeast? And like you said, Cahokia being this amazing city that, mm-hmm. that was built mm-hmm. outside of what is St. Louis today. So, as the settlers moved in, there was a kind of desire to, create a story that it was anybody but the native people. Mm-hmm. So, it could have been the Vikings. It could have been the Lost Tribes of Israel. It could have been the Chinese.
The Mormons, I think, played into that. Yeah, it was these, yeah.
Yep. So there were loads of different tales that were surfacing. And, you know, just as you said, about an hour's car drive from Bishop Hill was a really famous one called the Davenport Tablets, which if you go to the Putnam Museum today and you get to see them in person, you'll be able to take one look at them and realize that they are hoaxes. They're mm-hmm. really poorly done. Yeah. And they were actually meant to be poorly done.
Yeah.
They were meant to kind of make a fool of the person who found them. And they're actually carved into slate roofing tiles. And they even have the nail holes still. So it was meant to be an obvious joke, but it kind of blew up in their faces. Because people, it kind of went national. It was like a big national.
Oh, sure. Story. And once it did, they couldn't back off from it, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So now what I think intrigues me about this is all the evidence to the contrary. If there is a compelling enough political myth or narrative,
yes.
you're willing to set aside the objective evidence of your own eyes to drink the Kool-Aid. And we haven't gotten over that yet. we're still doing that.
We are still doing that. Indeed. Indeed. I think it's, you know, one of the things that comes out in the book and came out in our conversations with each other is that, you know, nation building or region building or place building is about stories and telling stories about those places, right? And in the absence of stories or in the presence of a story that you are not a fan of, mm-hmm. you need to invent new stories. And so these mountain builder myths were one way to kind of emplace white identity on the land that was being used and founded and established at this time.
Yeah.
I would just add to that, too, that in that sense, what we're trying to do in this book is to place this one village, Bishop Hill, into this much broader context. And this is a good example of it. And, you know, part of what we're trying to do is to talk about the Midwest in general.
Yes.
And how the idea of the Midwest came into being.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the tropes that are stories that people tell today about the Midwest all over the United States is that it's this blank canvas, it's flyover country. It can be very insulting to people mm-hmm. who live in the Midwest. But it's a story we tell ourselves that turns the complexity of three-dimensional history into a two-dimensional flat space, mm-hmm. you know, and it's really just not the case. So this kind of story that nothing ever really happened here, that it's a blank canvas, is just not true. And when you start really looking at the three-dimensional aspects of the Midwest, you start realizing just how fascinating and dynamic and, yes, ugly it can be. It was. Bloody things happened mm-hmm. here.
Yes.
According to one author who was... Yeah.
And thank you for introducing me to her. Tell us a little bit about this diarist. I didn't know anything about her.
That's shocking to me, actually, Kai, because you are the repository of all things Swedish in my mind. But yeah, so Fredrika Bremer, she was a fascinating character, and I'd love to learn more about her, actually. She was a Swedish feminist and author in the 19th century, mid-19th century. And in the middle of the 19th century, she took a de Tocqueville-inspired tour of the United States, and she would send missives back to Sweden mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. about what was happening in the United States. And so one part of her journey was down the Mississippi River, and she has wonderful, colorful descriptions of all the complexity, all the things that were happening down the banks of the Mississippi from the eyes of someone not from the area. And so a really sort of interesting perspective on what was happening in the United States at the yeah. time.
I really like this juxtaposition that comes together, because here we have, as you mentioned, her accounts, at least what I was reading there, and you're going to make me read more, so that's great. They are there's a lot of complexity mm-hmm. and nuance and subtlety in there, some intended, some not. But then you set that against this simpler times impetus
yes.
That is shot through the whole story there.
Yes.
Now, I've got an anthropologist and a political scientist, so I'm going to, of course, ask a question about psychology. Why do we need the simpler times? Because this is not yeah. just Bishop Hill.
Yes.
This is happening mm-hmm. all over our culture and all the time.
Yeah.
Not just now, but people have this fanciful image of something that was complex and nuanced, mm-hmm. but it's just sanded down to the simpler
yes.
times thing. Why do we do that?
I think it says more about us today than it does about the past.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I think we need times to be simpler somewhere out there because life feels really complex now for us. That's my little pop psych interpretation. But we desire that so much. And it's common in tourist places for the simplification of what the place is really
mm-hmm.
about. That's really common.
Yeah, I think, you know, it has to do with nostalgia and, you know, our sense of the modern being inherently complex, inherently difficult, inherently, you know, we've never lived in more polarized times.
Mm.
When in fact, you know, a cursory look at history will tell you that that is not necessarily true, right? Yeah. But that idea that somehow we can go back to a simpler time, that it is accessible to us, I think is sort of psychologically necessary. Yeah.
Well, I know for a fact that we do love to tell stories, right? We are very good at that, and we'll get more into that in just a little bit. But one of my favorite all-time storytellers was the late Dr. Roald Tweet.
Yes.
And even though he is no longer with us, I'm grateful that we still get to hear him each and every week here on The Conversation on WVIK. Friends, my guests are Dr. Margaret Farrar and Dr. Adam Call. Their book is Becoming Utopia, available from University of Nebraska Press. We'll be back in just a moment. But right now, it's time for Rock Island Lines.
This is Roald Tweet on Rock Island. That politics is a disease has always been well known, but few were aware that it could be transmitted from person to person until the Grand Excursion of 1854, which celebrated the arrival of the Chicago and Rock Island Railroad at Rock Island. Among the 1,200 prominent excursionists who arrived at Rock Island by train on June 5, 1854, and then took a flotilla of steamboats up the Mississippi to the Falls of St. Anthony, was ex-president Millard Fillmore. Although Fillmore had agreed to leave politics out of his speeches at river towns along the way, he had trouble doing so. He often talked at length of his administration and its policies. By the time the excursionist reached Galena, the other passengers had voted Fillmore's political speeches in bad taste. By then, however, it was too late. Here and there, a passenger had caught politics. When the boat stopped at Winona, Minnesota, for example, a Reverend Dr. Kennedy from Albany, New York, could not resist announcing his own candidacy for president. He told the assembled crowd, a settler and his son, that language utterly failed to express the emotions of his heart at such an enthusiastic reception. He promised every man in Winona a public office. He was in favor of every great principle of every political party. He was in favor of making every citizen rich. He concluded to wild cheering from his audience. By the time the steamboats reached St. Paul, Mose Kimball, director of the Boston Museum, had caught political fever. Accompanied by gestures suspiciously like President Fillmore's, Kimball announced his candidacy for president, promising, if elected, to appoint only women to cabinet and office posts, and to divide all property equally among all citizens. Wild cheering. Fortunately, the Grand Excursion ended right there at St. Paul. Otherwise, given the close quarters on the steamboats, there might have been an epidemic of politics, with hundreds of candidates for the presidency by the time the disease had run its course. And in those days, when people weren't even sure whether politics was spread by bacteria or a virus, that would have been disaster.
You know by now that usually you hear that calliope music fading out, but the reason you're not hearing it is, as I mentioned before, we had this massive power problem here at the radio station, and it knocked out two of our production or broadcast studios. So here's the thing, friends. Usually at this time every week, I tell you, head over to WVIK.org and look for that donate button. I'm going to be even more explicit. It's going to take a lot to fix two studios so that your public radio station can continue to bring that wonderful mix of music and news and public affairs. And if you've been kind of sitting on the fence for that $100 or, dare I say, $1,000 contribution, now's a super awesome time for you to go to that button called donate at WVIK.org. Jared Johnson, our general manager, and his team, they're doing a phenomenal job. Brady Peterson, if you listen to the newsroom, didn't miss a beat yesterday, despite all the hullabaloo. But if things are a little rough around the edges here on The Conversation, you can blame me and my inability to adapt to change. My guests are Margaret Farrar and Adam Call. They've written this lovely book called Becoming Utopia. And Tweet and stories and the stories we're talking about here, it strikes me that even at a personal level, right, we shade our memories. I mean, I had this glorious childhood, but I go back and I look at photos of the Quad Cities from the early 70s before gas was unleaded, and everything in the summer is hazy.
Yes.
I mean, that's a literal, you know, sort of rosy-colored memory of what was a gray and dingy time, you know?
Yes.
And we do that for our ourselves, in our families, and then also for cultures. But the silver lining for Bishop Hill is I don't want to, you know, live in an Illinois that doesn't have a quirky little place where I can get Swedish food specialties and and visit these kinds of things. So how do you feel, having lived this for about 11 years, about that balance between accurate storytelling and maybe productive storytelling? Mm.
I think that's where the subtitle History, Heritage, and Sustainability comes in, because there is a difference between a historical set of facts and figures and dates and names and the stories we tell about that history in the present, which is what we call heritage. So kind of creating, reshaping the narratives about what happened in the past leads you to a kind of understanding of heritage rather than history, right? So the two things are actually distinct from one another. Mm-hmm. So yeah, interpretation of what happened in the past leads you to history. And in a place where historic preservation is a huge part of what they're doing, mm-hmm. Making choices in the present about what to save, what to preserve, mm-hmm. and then, you know, something might literally be thrown out in the trash. So those are choices you're making about how to preserve a place. And then tourism, you have to craft simple narratives. Again, simplifying the narratives for a tourist audience. I mean, a lot of tourists don't want to listen to anything more than an 8-minute, 10-minute talk about the history of a place before they head off to lunch. So yeah, you have to kind of, as you said, sand away the rough edges a little bit in order to promote heritage tourism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Through the lens of the politics of public spaces, right? So choices have been made in Bishop Hill as to what to keep, what is no longer viable, that sort of thing. How do you look at that part of the story? Because, you know, all of us dropped into, even at the earliest, this colony, you know, a century plus into its life. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing it after a lot of these choices have been made. But when you look at it through your lens, Margaret, how does that inform your take on it?
I think the thing for me is I love a good Swedish meatball, you know, and I am totally in favor of cute little tourist towns that simplify history. But at the same time, I'm aware and cognizant of the fact that complexity is actually interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, the sort of depth of experience and depth of placemaking that happens at Bishop Hill, bringing that to the fore a little more might bring more tourists back, right? Like if you get the sense that you haven't scratched the surface of Bishop Hill, or you get the sense that there's more to the story here than you're mm-hmm. able to mm-hmm. see at one pass, that might actually lend itself, right, to repeat visits and the like. So to my mind, history and heritage, and I think this is true for Adam as well, but I'll pick on him a little bit. Like, I don't think they're not as dichotomous as perhaps he's indicating, or don't need to be. And in my mind, they shouldn't be as cleanly separated as they seem to be in some cases.
Yeah. There's a theory that is from another scholar, somebody named William Connolly, that you broached, that I just would love to hear more about: the ethos of existential revenge.
The ethos of existential revenge. Yes. Mm-hmm. One of the things that Connolly does that's really interesting, that I think we tap into in different ways in the book, is his work is largely about the power of pluralism and what pluralism, sort of telling multiple kinds of stories, allows us to do. And the opposite of that, of course, is to tell a single story, a fundamentalist story, whether it's about a religion or a culture or what have you. And so the question is, how do you acknowledge the need for simplicity and simple stories while also acknowledging the fact that pluralism is a fact, that we don't have a single story, and we have to keep finding new ways of telling different stories in a way that affirms them, if not equally, then with the same sort of attention to meaning, I guess I would say. Mm.
So something we have in common is that we're all from what would broadly be called the Great Lakes States originally, but it strikes me that the way the native story particularly is a part of your growing up is very different in Rock Island than it is, Adam, in Minnesota and Margaret in Ohio. muse on that with me for a bit. I mean, here our story is very simplified to there was a great laudable military leader who stood up for the rights of his family and was almost, you know, well, he was nearly murdered, but I mean, so many of his followers were, and then he becomes part of the American myth, and now we even name military equipment after him, right? Tell, what were the simplified stories in Ohio, Minnesota, for instance, that you'd want to share?
Yeah, well, I think in this region, you're right, we've collapsed the whole of Native white history into this one figure of Black Hawk and kind of moved on. And I think one of the interesting things, the contrast between this region and, as you said, I come from Minnesota, is sort of the absence of a Native presence here. You know, the Black Hawk War was so kind of powerful and violent and, you know, really did push Native people away. Whereas in Minnesota, you know, the Ojibwe people, the Dakota people, there's kind of an ever presence there. So one of the things we address in the book, and this actually ties back to the mound builder myths, is the presence-absence dichotomy and how what you're not seeing in this area is actually interesting too. There's a history there to why there's an absence of Native presence here.
And our former colleague, Steve Warren, would tell us that Ohio has a big part to play in the Native story. What about your growing up,
Indeed.
Margaret?
I mean, I think it's, more akin to what is happening in the Quad Cities or the way that we view sort of Native presence in the Quad Cities, in that it's a presence of absence rather than a continued presence, perhaps like in Minnesota. For us, of course, Ohio is home to the Great Serpent Mound, which, you know, is ground central, right, for the Mound Builder myths. Yeah. And those were extremely prevalent in Ohio in the 19th century, right? So it's a similar sort of story as we indicate here in the book, where we're telling stories that don't actually hold up to what the reality of Native history looks like.
So now I just want to talk a little bit while we have time about the process of writing this book, because you were a time zone apart from each other for most of the life of this project. But then we had COVID, when we got used to dealing with people down the block in the same way we deal with people in Cleveland. Yes. I mean, how did you guys do this across the miles?
I mean, in fits and starts over 15 years. Yeah. Yes. So there were moments of productivity, you know, the initial kind of data collection period for about 5 years, you know, early on. And then Margaret moved away to take this other position. Other projects got in the way. COVID got in the way. So there were a lot of kind of blips along the way. But when we finally decided to get back to it, we just said, you know, in fact, I think it was Margaret who just said, are we doing this or not? Like, let's either do this and we decided, no, there's something here, because every time we would pick back up on it, we would have a call or we'd text each other, and it would be like, actually, I think this is really good. There's some interesting ideas here. So eventually we just committed to finishing it. Most of that was over Zoom. But yeah, lots of things got in the way along the way, but actually we're really grateful for that, because now we have the perspective of 15 years, because communities are dynamic and changing all the time, and you don't want an analysis that is just a little snapshot in time. That's not really an accurate picture of the dynamism of a community. So we're grateful that it took so long, actually.
Well, I'm hoping that people are going to want to learn a lot more. Now, here we are Saturday morning. I say that for people who might be tuning in Monday night, but how could I find out more even today?
Even today.
Even today.
We're going to Bishop Hill to do a presentation and a book signing. We're going to be at the Steeple Building at 2:30. In Bishop Hill. So if you're interested, if you want a quick synopsis of the book, if you want to meet Adam and I and talk about the Mound Builder myths or anything else, we're happy to talk with you in Bishop Hill at 2:30.
Yeah. And if you're lucky, you might get a cabbage roll.
Absolutely.
But there's a fun little shop down there that they have things that Swedish Americans really love that you can't find anywhere outside of an IKEA. So I'll put in a plug for that too. Anything else about the learning more about the book? Will you be making any other appearances while you're here in town, Margaret?
Bishop Hill is the only, I think the only event that we have planned, but we will have an article coming out. Augustana Magazine is publishing an article about the book and about our process. And I think that's later this month, yes?
I don't know what the publication timeline is, but yeah, it'll be sometime in the future.
I ceased being editor of that publication in 2005. So
congratulations.
I trust my colleague, Debbie. She'll take care of everything. Everything will be wonderful.
She'll let us know.
Now, we've reached a part of the program, and I love it when I have very interesting people. I am just always looking for book recommendations or media recommendations of various kinds. Who wants to start? Who's reading something cool?
I finished something cool recently, but it's a little niche. So this is nonfiction. It's a book called Murderland by Carolyn Fraser. Mm. And what she's studying, and it really ties into what you were saying about Rock Island earlier, Kai, she studies the rise of serial killers in the 70s and 80s and links it to environmental toxins like leaded gasoline. So she's from the Seattle-Tacoma area, which was ground zero for a lot of toxins that were being put into the environment. And also, she says, not coincidentally, ground zero for serial killers. And it's a fascinating read about a specific place and a sort of specific cultural moment.
Say the title again.
Murderland.
Wow. That's wild. All right, try and top that, Dr. Cole.
Yeah, now I'm put on the spot here. I have two. One, a good book, and the other, maybe, I don't know, just pop culture, whatever. Lars Mitting has a trilogy called the Sister Bells Trilogy. It's set in rural 1800s Norway. Really beautifully written set of novels. So the Bell in the Lake is the first one, and the Reindeer Hunters is the second one. So I'm about five pages off from finishing that one. And then the other recommendation I'd make is I've been listening on tape to Dungeon Crawler Carl, which is a crazy, very sarcastic sort of fantasy sort of novel. So yeah, there you go.
Very cool. Well, I gives as I gets. And we've been enjoying this remake of The Four Seasons that's kind of led by Tina Fey. Yeah. And if you remember, a million years ago, Carol Burnett and Alan Alda made a film that was a delightful film about couples as life goes on, right? But we're almost done with season two. And this drives my spouse crazy. When she sees something she likes, we're going to spend 6 hours and we're going to binge. We're going to see the whole thing. Like, well, no, I want to. I grew up waiting a week for the next episode of my favorite shows. You know, we can't put it all in here right now, but that's delightful. I'm looking forward to, I have to say I've gotten caught up in the whole Odyssey thing. Mm-hmm. And so I've got on hold at Augie's library, the Aeneid, which I've never read. So I'm kind of anxious to see where that takes me. And the selfish part of that is years ago, Genesius Guild here in Rock Island, they had what we called our Trojan Summer. So they did the Greek play, the Trojan Women. They did Troilus and Cressida, the Shakespeare version of all that. And in that one, I got to play Aeneas. Mm. So I got to figure out what happened to him. But anyway, we're running out of time. I am so grateful that you came to be part of this conversation. Do you have any other projects in the hopper?
I'm currently working on a local project actually back in Cleveland about the preservation or destruction of the Shaker Lakes. And that is proving to be fascinating, and I've worked a lot on it this summer, so it's been a good time.
Very cool. Anything?
Yeah, my next book project with Autumn Hjortien at the University of Uppsala in Sweden, we're co-authoring a book about Swedish Americans and political polarization, so how families are having conversations across the political divide.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm so grateful that you both came and are here. And I hope you guys who are listening get a chance to find this book, Becoming Utopia, from University of Nebraska Press. And that, of course, has to do it for this particular episode. But remember, friends, you can catch the conversation twice each week on WVIK after the Saturday Morning Live version. There's also the rebroadcast Monday evenings at 8. Just find recent episodes at WVIK.org after looking for us on under the podcast tab. From the campus of Augustana College, this is Kai Swanson, inviting you to join us next week for the conversation on WVIK, when our guest will be local music legend and historian Nervous Neal Smith. I'm so grateful that for this week I had Margaret Farrar and Adam Call. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. Have a wonderful Saturday. Don't worry, it's going to dry up in here in a little bit, but get out and about because Sunday is going to be gorgeous. Thanks for tuning in.
Listening to The Conversation on WVIK. If you missed part of it or just want to hear it again, tune in at 8 o'clock on Monday evening, right here on WVIK. Support for WVIK, Quad Cities NPR, comes from the Regional Development Authority, distributing funds from the Rhythm City Casino Resort to help make the Quad Cities a more vibrant and inclusive community. Learn more at rdauthority.org.
I'm Judy McKinley from Coin Center, and WVIK is my NPR station.
With national and international news at the top of every hour and local news throughout your day, we're WVIK, 90.3 FM and HD Rock Island, and at 95.9 FM, K240DZ Dubuque, WVIK, Quad Cities NPR.